everybody's favorite bill. So, Senator Burdick, this is your baby.
Shall I go do my thing?
You can do it from there, or you can do it from there.
Oh, I'll do it from here, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank you for the record, I'm Ginny Burdick, District 18. I want to thank you for considering this bill today. The chorus of this bill reminds me of that old Beatles song, Long and Winding Road. But the way you see this bill, which is to allow businesses to get on the no-call list, business phone lines to get on the no-call list, it's now in the form of the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 27. And what the -2 amendments do is they, an earlier bill did, it allows business phone lines to get on the no-call list for solicitors. It's operated by the Department of Justice. It's a very well-regarded list where people pay $6 a year to get on the list. I believe it's $3 a year for renewal. And telemarketers are required to check to see if a phone line is on the no-call list before calling. And in the past, that service has only been available for private phone lines. And this would extend it to business phone lines. And it would also extend it to facsimile machines. Now, in the course of considering this bill, I got some comments from my constituents in the Tigard Chamber of Commerce who expressed concern that people who make their living selling insurance or providing financial services, that type of thing, small business people generally, could be quite burdened by the responsibility to check no-call lists before they can make a business contact. And sometimes it's a little bit unclear whether they would fall under an existing exemption for people who have an existing business relationship, because sometimes they go on leads. So to deal with that situation, I added an exemption to the business call list to exempt people who are making calls selling services from their own company. So telemarketers who are hired to make massive phone calls would still be covered by the requirement to check the no-call list before they make a call. But individual business people who are selling their own services, insurance salesmen or financial planners, et cetera, would be exempted from the law. And I feel this is appropriate for a business line. They do not enjoy this kind of exemption from the private phone lines, but for a business line, I believe that's justified given the slightly different nature of a business line. So this is a good bill. There are people in the audience who can answer technical questions. Grant Wolf, who represents the organization that runs the Oregon no-call list, is in the audience. And I believe Cheryl Pellegrini from the Justice Department is there as well if you have technical questions.
All right. Do we have a sign-up sheet?
Sure. Do we have the dash two?
You should have them in your packets. I do. Or maybe it's just me because I have privilege.
I've had it in my file.
I do not find them.
Minor technical problem.
I don't have it either.
Yeah.
We must get copies of that. All right, we're going to get copies of that. While we're doing that, I'm going to close the public hearing and shift to public work session on House Bill 2150. Where's my counsel?
There are no amendments.
2150, no amendments. You remember this bill, hopefully, from last week. This is one dealing with small estate affidavits. We held it up to make sure that we weren't doing something mysterious with respect to 217 and the other bill that we had from the Division of State Lands. Apparently we're not. So.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2150, if you recall, deals with
DHS, and it deals with some of the same issues that Warren Darris came and spoke on House or Senate Bill 64. And I spoke with Warren and Mr. Mills, and both have confirmed that there are no conflicts between the two bills. I also asked for a conflicts check from LC back then and hadn't gotten anything back, so I assume that means there are no conflicts as well. So I think the bill is ready to go, and I understand that there are no amendments, so it's ready to go.
Senator Ringo, did you have an issue with Section 3 of the bill and the affidavit?
Well, thanks for asking. As I mentioned, I feel a little bit badly for some of these people that have extremely small estates, and yet they're losing what little they have after grandma dies. But I do think it's appropriate that if the person's been receiving public assistance, then their state ought to pay that back to the state. So I'm voting yes.
All right, good. It's a work session. There are no amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
I would move House Bill 2150 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2158 and goes to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? No objections. The motion passes. Senator Starr, would you carry that one?
I will.
Thank you, sir. All righty then. Now, are we ready? We don't have the amendments yet.
We do not. They're coming, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick, could I ask Senator Burdick a question? Are we back on the 25th?
Let me. It's tough being a captain of a ship. Are you okay with 466 now? Do you want to do a work session on Senate Bill 466?
Amendments. I have dash ones. I think we've got dash twos, don't we?
No.
Just dash one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
I would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 466.
All right, Senator Burdick moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 466. Hopefully you guys will remember this is the metal underpants bill. And we're now amending section of the statutes dealing with possession of burglar's tools because it actually fits in there better, and which is apparently the statutory scheme that's currently used to try to prosecute these things. So, further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Senator Walker? Don't start on that issue.
I've taken a closer look at the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'm fine.
You're fine with it. Great. Thank you very much. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 466 to Senate floor, but it has as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 466 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yeah.
Senator Ringo.
I intend to vote yes, but I think it's appropriate that Senator Walker carry this bill.
I'm thinking the same thing. All right. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. Senator Walker will get to carry the metal underpants bill.
Do we have to change our clothing today, or can we get still another week?
Yeah, exactly. If I hear you clanking around the hallways, I'll know what's going on here. So. Still no copies. What else are we ready to go on?
Mr. Chairman, we're ready on 52, 421, and 301.
Work session, Senate Bill 52. Council, what are we
doing? Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 52 is the bill that if you have it as it was introduced, it would create aggravated identity theft. Mr. Chairman, I worked on several amendments to this, trying to get this down to a manageable fiscal, and was not able to do so. So you should have the dash 3 amendments, which will get it down, I believe, so it won't have to go to Ways and Means. And what it will do is it will delete Section 1 of the bill, which is the bill that deals with the aggravating factors for aggravated identity theft. And what will be left is Section 2, which is the bill that is a procedural change to the law. 131.315 is the statute that deals with prosecuting the way it reads now is a theft case. in one county, even if some of the theft actions occurred in other counties around there, you can prosecute them all in one place, which is more efficient. This would add forgery and identity theft to that statute.
All right.
That's threes.
So that pretty well neutralizes the fiscal.
Correct.
All right. Senator Walker, or excuse me, Senator Burke. Are you okay with the dash threes?
I guess.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 52. Discussion? Any objections? Motion passes. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 52 as amended to the Senate. What is the Senate's
Senate 4, actually. We just wiped out the
Senate 4
of
the decaster.
Now, is there a subsequent ways and means on this?
There is not, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 52 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Question.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, I just carried a bill on the Senate floor the other day putting identity theft into the RICO statutes, and I just assume that this is making it a stronger felony in the non-RICO statutes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, it's not changing identity theft at all as far as the penalties or anything like that. What it's doing is it allows a prosecutor, say you have someone who is doing identity thefts in Lane County and an adjacent county, which I can't think of an adjacent, is Benton? Okay. All right, anyways. Say they're doing identity thefts. They have a driver's license in your name, and they're draining your account in Lane County and in Benton County. Then you can do all of the identity theft counts in one county, rather than having two prosecutors in two counties do them.
Okay.
So it just facilitates prosecution.
The last time we heard this, beer.
Ooh.
You know, you mentioned Lane County and Benton County in one breath, and beer comes out. But.
Okay.
Well, they're college towns, what can I say? But last time I heard this bill was February 4th, and
yeah.
I just, you know, I have copious notes here about what we talked about, but I just had forgotten.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, we did, if you can, what I did is, Section 1 is what we talked about mostly, I think, back then, because that was the bill that was kind of going to be the focus of aggravated identity theft, and then we were going to have these three different ways that you could achieve an aggravated identity theft, which would be 10 or more identity theft occurrences in a 180-day period, a person who has had two prior convictions, or a person who you can show has done $10,000 worth of damage to someone. All of those would have sent it to Ways and Means. I tried to work with Mr. Lemon and Christian and the fiscal folks, and it was difficult to...
It's always hard working with Ann.
It is. Very, very difficult. Her personality is difficult.
She's still got a smile on her face, so that's good. And so, actually, we're just trying to avoid fiscals to the extent that it's practicable. Mm-hmm. So
that's why it's been so long, Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, is because I've been working on that and have kind of given up.
And we, my notes also indicate we're waiting on some of these other bills to come over from the House.
So we've done that. And Mr. Chairman and Senator Walker, there's the bill that you had, I believe, adding RICO.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a bill that is coming over from the House, which deals with RICO again and allowing trap and trace to be done. So now identity theft would be in there. There's not a whole lot of identity theft things coming over.
Okay. Well, I'm happy with Bill. I mean, I just think these people that do this are real scumbags because it really hurts innocent people. And there are a lot of crimes out there that people are physically injured and killed. But this one, I think, ranks right up there. It's been pretty devastating to families as well. So I'm okay.
All right. Okay, great. Any further discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion passes. Thank you very much. We do now have amendments to Senate Bill 27. I don't know if the committee needs some time to...
And Mr. Chair, do you want to carry that for 52?
I will. Senator Burdick.
We do have the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 27. This was kind of forced into a bill in sort of a convoluted way, so some of the language you would have to have Ms. Pellegrini explain what it means, but the substantive language in this is in line 9 on page 1, where it includes facsimile machines on the no-call list. And on page 2, line 10, the exemption I was talking about, exempting business-to-business calls where a business caller is selling their own services. That appears on lines 10 through 12 on page 2.
All right. Great.
Just careful.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, just as a comment, I'm certainly going to support this, but I wish that the exemption did not exist on page 2, line 10. And I just say that as somebody who has a small business in my law practice. And I get a lot of calls from people selling financial services. And I don't want to get those calls. You know, my secretary gets those calls and doesn't really know what they're about. And it wastes a lot of my time. I went into the office on Sunday to retrieve phone calls, and I had two messages from businesses that were selling vacation packages that I had, quote, won. And, I understand that that's the way they do business, but I think this exemption is too broad, and I would want to look at it in the future.
Mr. Chairman, to respond to Senator Ringo's point, the way I understand the calls, because I get those vacation calls too, the vacation calls would be covered because those are professional telemarketers. And this is a kind of a tough call, and it doesn't rule out that we might want to get rid of it in the future if businesses want that. It was a balancing act.
Right. I appreciate that.
All right.
Chair, I would move.
Hang on a second. I got to make sure we're in a public hearing on Senate Bill 27 again, officially. Yeah, and we have Cheryl Pellegrini here from Department of Justice to chat. Other issues? You want to say something?
Yes, I had a question of Senator Burdick. I was going to ask you about the fax machines, and it does apply to fax machines. Does your exemption on page 2, line 10 apply to fax machines as well?
I believe it does.
We'll have Cheryl. Cheryl Pellegrini, can you come up here and explain this fine piece of legislation to us?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm employed as an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice in the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section. I would note for the record that it is my section that enforces Oregon's no-call statutes. Just a minute worth of background on this. The no-call law as we see it today is a result of an amendment made by the legislature in 1999 that replaced what we all formerly called the Black Dot Law with the current no-call provisions. The Black Dot Law permitted a telephone directory publisher to place a black dot by a person's name, and then the theory was, or the law said, that a telemarketer could not call anyone that had a black dot by their name in the phone book. It was revamped in 1999 to add the provisions that allow the Attorney General to contract with a list administrator to maintain a list of phone numbers of persons who do not wish to be called. None of the other provisions in the no-call law, in the telephone solicitation law, were amended at that time. So the amendments that are now being proposed actually amend the original provisions of the bill as it was enacted in 1989. Just a little bit of history for you. 1989 was the original telephone solicitation law with the black dot provisions. Okay. That was in 1989, the legislature set up and created the exemptions that Senate Bill 27-2s would now amend. As far as the dash 2 amendments, on page 2 it would be page 2, line 10. I understand that Senator Burdick is seeking to permit calls by a business calling on its own behalf to solicit the sale of property, goods, or services. I am not certain that this language would is narrow enough to accomplish that. And I say that because telemarketers, when they're hired by a business, they don't have any goods or services of their own to sell. They basically stand in the shoes of the business for which they are calling. So I think that, the language to purchase the caller's property, goods, or services may have the unintended effect of allowing professional telemarketers also to come in under this exemption. And I
discussed this at some, Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. I discussed this at some length with legislative counsel to specifically not allow that to happen. I don't see how telemarketers could get in. They don't have services to sell other than telemarketing services.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I only say that because if you look at line 4 above, it makes a clear distinction that calls made by a charitable organization, a public agency, or volunteers on behalf of the organization or agency members to persons who have donated, those calls are not covered. In reading the calls to the language in line 10, I think is not as specific as the language on line 4. And I think that the lack of specificity in line 10 or on line 11 may be interpreted by a court to permit calls made by telemarketers who are calling on behalf of a business to sell the business's services, because a telemarketer doesn't have any independent services of its own. So I just am concerned, I'm raising the concern, that it may permit a telemarketer to call on the theory that it would argue that it is in fact offering the goods of the business for which it is calling for sale.
No, it's caller's property. Caller's property, goods, or services. So the way I read this amendment, the only service that a telemarketing firm could call and offer to sell are telemarketing services.
Okay. I'm just, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I'm not quarreling with what the amendment is attempting to do. I'm just raising a concern about the extent to which it may accomplish its purpose. But if you're satisfied and if legislative counsel is satisfied, then you can disregard my comments.
Well, no, I appreciate the comment. I'll have them take another look at it, but I specifically, asked for that. It's lovely when the lawyers maybe we'll get our own counsel in on the deal at some point.
All right.
And then just one more comment,
sure.
Mr. Chair. There is a carve out in on page 3 of the dash 2 amendments at line 3. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act does provide for class action suits to be maintained for violation of certain provisions. What the dash 2s would do is that they would carve out from class action suits a violation of FF that is a business to business contact.
Okay.
Right, so there could be no class action maintained for the business that calls another business. I don't know that that extends to facsimile machines.
I'm sorry?
I don't know that that extends to facsimile machines.
All right. So we're unclear on that point. Okay, great. All right.
Yeah.
Senator Rigo.
I just want to follow up. What is this carve out under the FF? You're looking at the bottom line of page 3.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I am. And if you look up at line 3 on page 3.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, say that again.
Line 3 right. On page 3, subsection 4.
Right. You look at those.
It talks about class action suits.
Correct.
And then that the section does not apply to basically a violation of the odometer laws or violations that are business-to-business contact related.
Do you look at the...
Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I'm sorry, if I may, let me just look at this in the larger context of the statute. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I misspoke. What subsection B, line 30, page 3, does is that it precludes a private action for violation of for a call that's a business-to-business contact. That's what it seems to do. ORS 646-638 generally describes civil actions by private parties.
Chairman.
Subsection 8.
Verdict.
It was my understanding when this was drafted that because of the relating clause of Senate Bill 27, in the usual no-call, there are two remedies. One is through the Attorney General's office, and one is through private action.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this relating clause, we could only provide one remedy, the Attorney General's remedy, and the private action was not allowable under it. And that's why that's excluded from that.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, Senator Burke, that is exactly what it does.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, I am not comfortable with that explanation just given. The relating clause says relating to remedies. I mean, it doesn't refer to whether it's a civil remedy or by the Attorney General's office. I don't accept that explanation. And I'm not questioning you. I'm questioning legislative counsel.
Right. And, Mr. Chairman, I questioned that as well. And then I learned that most of the actions that are taken for violations, at least in the personal area, are indeed run through the Attorney General's office. So I didn't feel that it would make a substantive difference in terms of enforcement to have the civil remedy not allowed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not sure I'm following or tracking through this, but I think it is very important to have a civil remedy. I think there are many cases where the Attorney General's office is too busy to get involved in an issue, and that's why you've got to have a civil remedy. And I would be concerned, I mean, Senator Burdick, is what you're suggesting is that this does not allow for a civil remedy, and I would be concerned if that were the case.
And I'm trying to remember... Unlawful trade practices, isn't that exclusively enforced by the Attorney General or not?
Mr. Chair, it does have a private cause of action.
It does. Okay.
But the...
What did we do? Didn't we do something with that last session with the Illinois BRIC issue in making the Attorney General? Is that related or different?
Mr. Chair, that's a little bit further.
A little bit, okay.
Forward in the unlawful trade practices provisions,
okay.
Generally.
So this there currently is a private action allowable under...
Yes. The difference is that a person to maintain a private action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act must show some ascertainable loss of money or property in order to maintain that action. And then they can bring an action for $200 or actual damages, whichever is greater. The Attorney General's authority is a little bit different. You don't have to make that showing of ascertainable loss, but by the same token, because of the requirements placed on the Attorney General's office by Chapter 180, we don't and cannot bring an action on behalf of a single private individual who has suffered a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, we would bring an action if we found that a business engaged in a pattern of unlawful practice affecting the public in general. So that's the difference.
All right. Good. Senator Ringo.
Could you just go through one more time the sentence beginning at the bottom of page 3? That, including that subsection B, means that a person cannot bring a private right of action for this type of violation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe that what page 3, line 30, subsection B does is that it amends the current section 646-638, which describes generally the procedure for bringing a civil action if you're a private party. And section 8 says that this section, civil actions for private party, does not apply to any method, act, or practice described in 646-608-1Z, and that is actions for odometer violations. And this would add, or a violation of 646-608-FF, if that violation relates to a business-to-business contact, and in this context, it would be without regard to whether or not the contact business to business was by a telemarketer or by a business on its own behalf.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Sure, go ahead.
Let's assume that you got a call from some business who says, I was called by a solicitor even though my number was listed on the no call list. What would the Attorney General's office do with that complaint?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, are you talking about now or assuming that Senate Bill 27-2s are in effect?
Assuming this passes.
If a business calls us and says, I was contacted, what we would do is we would have the business file a written complaint with us. If that was the only complaint we received about the alleged offending business, we would likely take no action. We may send a letter to the other business saying that we received a complaint, but we would not institute a formal enforcement action based on the facts that you've just recited.
And you said earlier that you do initiate an enforcement action if the complaint is widespread. I mean, how many complaints do you need?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the way that we've been enforcing the no-call provisions, if we get two or three complaints about a business, we'll put the business on notice. If we get more after that in a close time period, we'll initiate a enforcement action and would probably take action.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I mean, do you currently have the staff to aggressively handle complaints on the no call list?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I have devoted to this program one full-time assistant attorney general and paralegal and support staff. This is a program that since its inception in 2000, we have aggressively enforced, which I think is why it's been so successful.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pellegrini, a follow-up to that question by Senator Ringo, however, the co-chair's budget has deleted all appropriations to the Consumer Fraud Division in the next biennium. So tell me how that impacts this program and your whole division.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that is probably a question best answered by Attorney General Myers, because ultimately it will be the Attorney General's decision. I can tell you that it will eliminate 35% of my section's operating budget, and that certainly that raises the specter of having to reduce staff. But again, I hesitate because that's a decision that the Attorney General will make. But it certainly will have an effect on our ability, and it may well require us to reorganize our priorities in terms of the types of cases that we take. So, insofar as Senator Ringo's question, you're right. You know, we may not be enforcing this particular statute as aggressively as we have in the past if we have fewer people to handle all of our cases in general.
Mr. Chair, one more question. With regard to fax machines, you don't have a clear answer about some of the provisions and whether they apply to fax machines, because your answer was you don't know if this extends to fax machines in terms of the carve-out on page 3, line 2. Also, I remember reading about some business owner or person, I can't remember if he's a business owner or what, who got a lot of these faxes for free vacations and this and that, the kind of junk fax that I get. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a law about that, and he started individual suits against all of these people and I believe got money in court for doing that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, there does exist an Oregon law, and I'm sorry, I don't. It's in 646, the trade practices chapter. There is a law currently that prohibits a person from sending a facsimile to another person if the receiver has contacted the business in writing and said, basically, don't fax me again.
Okay.
So there is that requirement that you receive an unsolicited fax, you notify the person in writing that you don't want to receive any more. If you do receive more, then it's a violation of that statute. Has a separate penalty provision in it, and also the Attorney General has the authority to bring an action to enforce against violators of that provision.
Okay.
So this would be different. This would prohibit the first fax, I think, is what this would do.
But then my concern, Mr. Chair and Ms. Pellegrini, is this exemption from a private right of action that Senator Ringo's been questioning you about. Will that impact the ability to bring an action?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, if I can just look at this for a minute. Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think that the way faxes are added in is that they are simply added to the definition of a telephone solicitation. I think that a private right of action does exist for facsimile machines.
Okay.
So
you think it does?
I do, because of the way that legislative counsel has constructed this. He's made facsimile machines part of the definition of telephone solicitation on, it's in section 1, subsection 6. Telephone solicitation means a solicitation by telephone or facsimile machine by any person of a party for the purposes of encouraging the party. Then 646.569, which is the actual enforcement provision of the no-call law, says that a person may not engage in the telephone solicitation of a party at the telephone number included on the then current list published by the administrator. So because they built facsimile machine into the definition of telephone solicitation, I think that it would provide for a private right of action insofar as a private right of action does now exist for a violation of the no-call laws.
Okay.
And it does.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Breed.
To simplify, the facsimile machines are going under the structure that already exists for private phone lines. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Breed, that is correct.
Okay, that's my understanding as well.
All righty then. Any further questions for Ms. Pellegrini? There are none.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Would have been a lot easier to deal with the original bill.
Yeah.
Well, but that's why we're here. I want to do a couple of really quick things because there's people waiting for some amendments and bills to move in different places. I want to try to clear that, and we'll come back to this, if that's okay. Then close the public hearing on Senate Bill 27, and I want to move to Senate Bill 3. 01. Mr. Prinz, I understand we have amendments to that bill.
There are, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 301, you'll recall perhaps we heard testimony on this quite a while ago from the DA's Association, and also testimony from either Susan Russell or Ingrid against. Looks like it was Susan. Kamala Sugar's here, Gina Skinner's here, Susan Russell's here on this. This is the bill that deals with unlawful imprisonment, and you may recall there was discussion about how this bill would relate to the current crimes of kidnapping and coercion. I believe there was a discussion about that. I want to, there's two amendments, and I think the proponents are asking that you look at the dash one amendments, and Ms. Russell is asking that you look at the dash two amendments. And if I could find my amendments, I would explain them.
Well, the dash one amendment.
Yes, I've got it now, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The dash one amendments would change the basically the state of mind requirement. So if you look at line four of the bill, to commit this crime, a person would, if the person with the intent to interfere substantially with another person's liberty, if the person knowingly confines. So there'd have to be that specific intent of interfering substantially with another person's liberty. Incidentally, I should have mentioned Mr. Harkelrode is here, the district attorney of Lane County, also on this. And then the other thing is just a technical change that Virginia made, I think, where in line five, changing another to the other. So that is the dash one amendment that the proponents would actually look at. The dash two was written for Susan Russell, and this would change the state of mind, or excuse me, would change the one element of the crime. They have to be instilling the other person a fear that the person will cause physical injury, damage of property, or engage in conduct constituting a crime. That is Ms. Russell's amendment. Mr. Chairman, there's not a fiscal yet on this, but Mr. Lemon has said that he believes it would be about 10 beds, which would be over $50,000. So you have all your options. You can either send it to Ways and Means, send it to the floor, whatever. And we can work out the fiscal.
All right. Question. Senator Walker, did you?
Yes, I have a question of counsel. I'm concerned about, on the dash one, the line five change from the other to another, because the way I would read that is confines another person without another person's consent. So you could get consent from someone else?
No, I think what...
person you're trying to confine?
Senator Walker, I think it does the opposite. It would make it so that it would have to be you'd confine the person without the person's consent. So it I think, actually is a technical amendment to deal with your concern that you raised, but it would make it clear that it has to be that person. I don't know if anyone worked with Virginia on that, but that's how I read it. So that it makes it clear that if you confine the person without the person's...
Well, assumedly you have at least two persons engaged in the conduct, and the other person whose liberty is being deprived is the person we're speaking of.
Correct.
In my sense, Mr. Chair, there could be three people here, and a third person gives a consent for that person to be confined.
It's kind of clumsy this way, because the way it reads with the amendment is that the person knowingly confines the other person without the other person's consent.
Right. But there's an underlying assumption here that you have two people involved as opposed to more than two.
But when it reads without another person's consent, it tells me there could be three people involved in this transaction.
Why can't you say without another person without that person's consent?
All right, hang on a second. Senator Stark.
The amendment deletes another, replaces it with the other. Makes it very clear to me.
Just deleted the other and put in another.
No, it deletes another.
Delete another.
Another is the current language.
Okay.
Let's engross it.
There's too many other persons and other persons on that line. It's driving me nuts. But thank you, Senator Starr, for pointing out my error.
All right. So, Susan Russell, Mr. Harper Rhodes, come forward, please. We must make a decision.
Chairman, it's the actual experts for the prosecution side that are sitting right over here. In fact, this is who they came for. That's all.
Well, they can come forward too if you want, but we need to move this along quickly. We have a choice, one or two, and let's hear the arguments quickly. Ms. Russell, tell us why you think your amendment is better.
Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're not asking you to make a choice. We are not opposed to the Dash 1 amendments. We are asking you, in addition, to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. I don't think there are alternatives. In our opinion, the Dash 1 amendments do not go far enough. If you remember, we had a sort of detailed conversation that there really is a lack of a requirement of an unlawful purpose or an intent to harm with the bill, even with the Dash 1 amendments. We could get into situations, for example, and I think we talked in some detail, about the parent that grounds the child or another person who is looking after an individual. There is no exception under the parent discipline for confining someone. Having a child be punished by a time out or having somebody be grounded in their room, depending upon the length, could qualify as unlawful imprisonment. There are a number of other situations where we're talking about, I think we gave the example both also where somebody says during an argument, don't leave until we finish this conversation, but does nothing to restrain that person or attempt to, does nothing to instill in that person a fear that they are going to harm the person. That all those kind of situations where a discussion is going on when someone uses words to the effect of, don't leave until we're finished with this, or you're not going to leave until this discussion is done, would qualify as unlawful imprisonment as it's currently drafted. The language in Dash 2 is sort of a simplified version of the intent to harm that's required in the coercion statute. So this is a standard that has been recognized and is currently in use, and I believe that it is a good amendment to this unlawful imprisonment, and it does cover our concerns about a requirement that there be an intent to harm, and as I say, it's widely drafted to include engaging in any conduct that constitutes a crime.
All right. Thank you. DAs.
Where I see this is the Dash 1 amendments are fine, so we're just chair minutes, members of the committee.
Right.
For the record, Doug Harkle, the district attorney in Lane County. So the Dash 1 amendments, as I see it, are just fine.
Right.
So the question is the Dash 2, and now I turn to the experts.
All right. And which expert will speak?
Which expert?
Compline Sugar from Lane County.
Thank you.
The Dash 2 amendments essentially create a second crime of coercion. ORS 163275 already has the language instilling in another person the fear that the person will cause physical injury, damage property, or engage in conduct constituting a crime. If you pass the Dash 2 amendments, you basically reduce the crime of coercion, which is now level 7, to a level 5, which is what this crime is proposed to be. What this bill was proposed to handle were situations that don't constitute coercion, situations where a person is held against their will in a place they are likely to be found, unlike the kidnapping statute where they're held in a place they're unlikely to be found. A lot of domestic violence incidents happen in a bedroom of the home, a place a person is likely to be found. They're being held against their will. The person has the intent to interfere substantially with their liberty, but there's no overt threat of physical injury. If the person damages property in the house, it happens to be joint property, usually marital property, so there's no damage to property. There's no other crime that's being committed. There's no menacing. There's no interfering with making a 911 call. There's just simply you're being held against your will in your room, in a closet. This does not apply to situations involving parents. If you read ORS 161205, the use of physical force upon another person is justifiable and not criminal conduct when a parent is entrusted with the care or supervision of a minor and engages in conduct that the person reasonably believes is necessary to maintain discipline or promote the welfare of the minor. This does not invoke any criminal charges against parents for reasonable actions regarding their child. However, clearly an unreasonable action regarding a child might constitute that crime.
All right. That's good. Thank you.
Right.
Hang on a second. Committee, where are you?
Mr. Chair.
One and two, one. Senator,
I just had a question. Are you saying, when you mentioned the thing about the coercion statute and that this would be going to downgrade it, are you saying that in that circumstance, if someone had someone entrapped in a bedroom and they did instill in the other person a fear that the person will cause physical injury, damage property, or engage in conduct constituting crime, are you saying that under existing law, if those set of facts applied, that they could be prosecuted under the coercion law?
Yes.
Do you agree with that? If I can ask Ms. Russell.
I believe the coercion, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the coercion statute involves an additional element, sort of a complicated way of, it's drafted quite the words are sort of complicated, but the gist of it being coercion requires an addition, that the defendant either require the victim to do something that he or she has a right not to do, or that the defendant prevent the victim from doing something he or she has a right to do. So there's an additional element, and I believe we had testimony from the proponent of the Virginia bill as to sort of the clumsiness or difficulty sometimes of proving that additional element, but that is an element that is present in the coercion that's not in this bill.
All right, committee, where are we? Senator Ringo.
I guess I'd like to ask a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's say college kids in the dorm are playing pranks and one locks the other in his room for a half hour. Is that a violation of this?
Chairman, as Senator Ringo, I think technically there are a lot of situations that could be violations of this statute. However, that is something that we would consider along with all the other charges that might be charged. That might be hazing if it is involved in a college prank. It might be some other behavior. Whether that gets charged by the prosecutor in that county is another question. I think when I met with Senator Ringo a week or so ago, we talked about a situation that was similarly ridiculous, and clearly it didn't get prosecuted by our county. And I think, however, if there was a college kid that was locked in a room and terrified and by that experience, and they were locked there for if it substantially interfered with their liberty, and I think most of the members of the committee have the memo that was prepared by Gene Kunkel of the Marion County DA's office regarding the definition of what substantially interfering with another person's liberty is defined as by the courts. I think you would turn, if that case ever did go to trial, if it ever got to that point, that would be something that the trial court would decide involving what constitutes substantial. And in State versus Garcia, the court has actually determined that substantial can apply both to either a distance that a person has taken or a period of time in which they're confined. So I think the reason that we submitted this memo to you is so you can consider that the trial courts do take into consideration each of the different circumstances that involve each case. And we can't, sitting here, guess what all the circumstances might be, but the courts have interpreted that language in the kidnapping statute, and they would probably be required to consider their own interpretation in applying the same language to the false imprisonment statute.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
If we're to choose between the two amendments, I guess I would prefer that we do add the dash two, but I'm going to vote against the bill just because I don't think that it's in our interest to continually create additional crimes to address small windows of behavior that, although bad, are already covered in other places of the statute. And I've said this before in the committee, our country has 2 million people in jail right now, and I would rather spend more time trying to figure out how do you get fewer people in jail, not more people in jail. I just don't think this solves any problem. I really don't. And I appreciate the district attorney's comment that my example, the college kid's locked in his room for half hour, she said technically it could be considered a violation of this. Well, technically, of course. And yes, district attorneys have a lot of discretion, and we're writing laws not to get... I don't think our purpose in this committee is to write additional laws to give them broader and broader discretion. I don't think that's what we're here to do. That's why I'm voting against this.
All right. Other committee members, help me with it.
I'm kind of on the fence on this, Mr. Chairman. It's, I could go either way. I really sympathize with what Senator Rigor is saying. I think we have a situation that everyone agrees is a really bad situation, and people shouldn't be doing that. I think there are other ways to get at it, either through domestic violence statutes or other criminal coercion or whatever. So I'm pretty lukewarm about it, but if you really want to do this, I can.
Well, I guess my view is that many of the victims of this kind of conduct are women in domestic violence circumstances. I think the issues that we heard before is the current language is somewhat torturous to try to get the coercion issue or kidnapping and try to actually make that conduct illegal. I mean, it seems to me that prosecutors are going to have to pass the laugh test on some of these things. I mean, you're just not going to take something to a grand jury that any reasonable person is going to look at and say, well, why would you even bother? Because you're not going to get an indictment and take it to jury trial. You're not going to get a conviction. I look at this more as not creating a new crime, but actually clarifying what I think should be criminal conduct that's not currently very clear in statutory language. So I think these cases are, for the most part, prosecuted to some degree, but it's very, very difficult to try to explain or articulate that to a grand jury or to a jury why this should be kidnapping or why this is a coercion. And I think it's pretty tough to explain to a victim that, you know, they were held against their will, their liberty was constrained, maybe pushed around, and et cetera, and the DA to have to say, look, we really don't have an instrument here that we can help you with. You weren't concealed. You weren't taken from one place to another. But the victims still feel as strong about that issue. And you do have a proportionality issue in terms of size and strength. And more often than not always, but men are, in fact, persons restraining another person. And there tends to be an issue of who's more powerful. So that's the way I see it. Frankly, I think the specific intent to interfere substantially with another person's liberty makes it very strong, but that's just my opinion.
Mr. Chairman.
So you're welcome.
Thank you. I'm going to support my district attorney on this one. They've been in my office talking to me about this case that brought this bill forward. And I understand Senator Ringo's concern. But I agree with you. I don't think if I was a DA, I'd take that dormitory case and prosecute it. There's a lot of laws that we have that technically you could be charged with, but I think the DA would have to be pretty stupid to go forward with that. The other issue was that Ms. Russell's concern was still that parents wouldn't be able to discipline their children, but Ms. Sugar has cleared that up and made it clear that that is covered under another statute. So if you do have an unruly teenager, which many of us have had in our lives and still have, like Senator Vertica, that, you know, teenagers, one day they're up and the next day they're kind of wacky. But I'm going to support my DA on this. I think they know what they're talking about, and I'm going to support the dash one and not the dash two.
All right. Senator Vertica.
Mr. Chairman, just to elaborate, I actually have concerns about the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments, in my view, if you're going to do this, they put the intent on the person who's perpetrating the dash twos. I think would be hard to work with because you're depending on something, a feeling that the victim would have. And I just, to me, that's kind of muddy. So I'd be happy to move the dash two if people are comfortable with those, but I will personally oppose them.
All right. How about we move the dash one?
Okay, I move the dash one amendment.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the dash one amendment. Discussion? Additional discussion? No additional discussion. Any objection? No objection. Motion. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be prepared to support the dash two amendment. To support my district attorney.
You want to do what now?
I will be prepared to support the dash two amendments.
That's the criminal defense lawyer's
amendment. Oh, thank you. Mr. Chairman, dash one is the
amendment. Okay. All right. Thank well, we just adopted it, so you're fine. Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, if you would like me to move the dash two amendments, I will do so.
Actually, the chair doesn't support the dash two amendments. So, but I'll do whatever the committee wants.
I don't want to move the dash two.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bree.
I would move Senate Bill 301 as amended by the dash one amendments to the Senate floor of the review pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 301 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Senator Ringo, you're still dissenting.
Yeah.
Any other opposition? No votes. All right, motion passes. Senator Ringo dissenting, and Senator Walker, would you be so kind to carry that bill?
I will.
Okay.
I know my DA will get me a talking point.
Yes.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll work with LFO to see if we can, you know, see what to do with that.
All right.
It may need to come.
421, real quick. Yeah, we have amendments because this needs to go.
We do. That's Mr. Chairman. We got two amendments to Senate Bill 421, and we also have a fiscal that you should have that is on the dash one amendments. The dash, by the way, the fiscal says it's 11,000 this biennium. And then 251 next biennium. So just want to notify that. I don't know what that means exactly, is what the with the cutoff. This is a bill that's from Senator Corcoran. We had a similar bill last session. The Pratts are here. They testified on this bill. And this deals with criminally negligent homicide and would elevate criminally negligent homicide to a level 9 on the sentencing guidelines. I borrowed, I think it's the Pratts have this sentencing guidelines. This is the sentencing guidelines grid. Criminally negligent homicide is currently a level 8, and that means that if a person did not have a prior felony, two or three adult non-person felonies, they would be in this orange area, which means that they could go to probation without any aggravating or mitigating, any mitigating departure factors. And this would move criminally negligent homicide and manslaughter 2 to a level 9 so that the presumptive sentences would be prison. And this is for, again, criminally negligent homicide is killing someone with a criminal, when you're criminally negligent. That is more than negligence. That means that you... you did fail to notice something, but it was a gross departure, and it would be the other is manslaughter in the second degree. That is for reckless behavior. Manslaughter in the second degree is a ballot measure 11 offense. It is a 75-month mandatory sentence. So these we're elevating both of these to a 9, so that there's no proportionality problem if we only. Crim neg hom is a lesser offense than manslaughter 2, so we'd have to move both of them. Now, the amendments, there's a dash 1, and this would limit it, and this is something I did to work on the fiscal. The dash 1 would limit this to only crim neg hom or manslaughter if it was in a motor vehicle with a DUII, which is, so it wouldn't deal with some of the other issues. Any other fact scenario, and that is done because that is specifically what the proponents wanted to most wanted to focus on was drivers who are under the influence of intoxicants driving motor vehicles. 421-2 is more of a, I would say, in one sense, a technical amendment. It moves it from a Class C to a Class B. A Class C felony, the maximum is 5 years. And a Class B, the maximum is 10 years. Now, you couldn't lawfully give a 10-year sentence on something like this. You wouldn't be following the sentencing guidelines. But what that allows is, if a person does go to prison, it would allow them, you'd allow enough time for them to also cover their post-prison supervision. Meaning, after they get out of prison, they'd still be on parole, what used to be parole. If we didn't change that, that maximum 5 years would be eaten up basically by the time they're in prison, and then you couldn't do the full 3 years of post-prison, if that makes sense. Okay. So it's allowing for the full sentencing guidelines sentence to be in effect on a crim neg homicide.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ringo.
Craig, you said that it moves it to a level 9, and the level 8 does not have mandatory sentencing, the level 9 does.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, sentencing guidelines there are sentencing guidelines for Measure 11, but if you look, you can't see this, but the maximum that would be, say you did have a criminal history, would be a 40-month presumptive sentence, okay? Presumptive meaning the judge could depart. Measure 11 on manslaughter 2 is 75 months, so it takes it out of that sentencing guidelines, basically. Now, moving it to a level 9, the only way it would change a sentence on manslaughter 2 would be it would technically and possibly a judge could depart from a 75-month sentence upwardly if he found aggravating factors, and you could, changing this to a 9 could make that departure a little bit longer. I find that very, very unlikely that a judge would depart from a sentence to the level where that would really matter, because it would have to be a double, twice the maximum presumptive sentence. Am I losing? I don't know if that makes sense, but
makes sense to me.
That makes sense.
All right.
No.
That's okay.
You okay? Nope. Mm-hmm. Yes. Where are we?
Well, Mr. Chair, I recall that when we had our hearing on this before, we had a number of horrendous examples of horrible behavior with horrible results. And the common thread through all of those examples was alcohol. And I made the comment that I think our society needs to draw a line in the sand to prohibit people from getting behind the wheel who are intoxicated. And that if people do that, they need to be hammered. If they do it repeatedly, the hammer needs to get progressively heavier. But I am concerned with increasing penalties for criminally negligent homicide that could be conduct that is not, while bad conduct doesn't rise to that level of evil. And I gave an example of something from my law practice where some woman was driving along the road and swerved to miss a goose in the middle of the road and killed three people when she hit the vehicle, the oncoming vehicle. Very, very sad example, but it's not somebody who drives drunk repeatedly and willingly and willfully. And I, whether that rises to criminally negligent homicide is, it's a judgment call. But I.
But don't these amendments constrain it to just instances where they would be under the influence of intoxicant?
Correct. Well, then I'm not following that.
If I understand correctly.
All of the dash ones.
Right. So it would, in your circumstance, this woman would have to be intoxicated when she swerved.
I'm sorry. I am much more amenable to this thing.
All right. Great. Senator Burdick?
I withdraw that discussion.
Forget everything I said past hello.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick? Both, actually. Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the Dash 1 Amendment, Senate Bill 421. Any further discussion? Any objections? No objection. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 421.
Senator Burdick moves the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 421. Is there additional discussion? Any objections? No objection. Motion passes. Now, this fiscal for this biennium is only $11,616.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
It is below the threshold.
Let's just call it roll up.
Yes, but I'm not concerned about that. So, Senator Burdick.
Chairman, I'm
not
concerned with
thank you.
Mr. Senate for Senate Bill 421 as amended. Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 421 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections to the motion?
Mr. Chair, I'm just pleased that we've been able to work this out. The Pratts have worked very hard on this, and we had a lot of compelling testimony. I'm ready to roll.
I think Phil Lemon had something to do with kind of helping narrow this, too, if I recall, in the hallway discussion, so I appreciate his work.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I guess I wish to extend my appreciation as well, because I think this is, it is a step in the right direction, and so I appreciate that.
Great. Okay. Motion passes. Senator Ferrioli, if you'd be wanting to carry this. All right. Now we're finished with the other work that we had to do. We'll shift back into Senate Bill 27 for more exciting discussion. Senate Bill 27. And I think we were at the point where Ms. Brandis was our next victim. Yes, I do.
That's always really comforting. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. I'm sure it's of no surprise to most of you that we are here in opposition to Senate Bill 27. We have met numerous times with Senator Burdick, and I think she has done, she's tried to exempt one of the concerns that we've had. And that is in regards to, you know, the exact business-to-business call, the insurance agents, that type of thing. And that is important because, like Senator Burdick, we did get a lot of phone calls from chambers who are members of AOI about how relationships are developed in a chamber or a rotary, their personal relationships, and then you establish a business relationship from that. And I think that's important. I think maybe one of the points that the Department of Justice was making is that language might be better if the language was what my fifth grade teacher at Harding Elementary School would have said. You need parallel language to make it flow with the rest of the statute. And that, but I'm not a lawyer. I just, in reading it, it didn't seem to flow with the rest of the statute. The second concerns that we've had, and that is in relation to the telemarketing. And you know, I understand that telemarketing is an irritation and a frustration. However, our organization has a very strong philosophy that competition is good, and whether you like telemarketing or not, it's a legitimate way to do business as long as you're not conducting a fraud operation. I think we saw some indications about what occurs when you're telemarketing and then mis-selling something, as we saw on the front page of the Oregonian today. And maybe one way I could explain why we have concerns about this is if you, I often appear here in this committee with the retailer general business hat on from AOI, but as many of you know, I lobby energy issues on behalf of Associated Oregon Industries. And here is a situation where telemarketing in the future is going to become more important as the energy market develops and more competitors come into the market. Because right now, the only business-to-business relationships that exist when you're providing a competitive commodity of energy are those relationships a customer, a business, might have with PacifiCorp or PGE. However, Strategic Energy and New Energy and a variety of other companies eventually are going to want to come in and provide the competitive commodity to businesses in the state. And they're going to call, and they're going to do telemarketing, and they're going to say, hello, Target, this is New Energy Ventures, and we want to provide you your energy services. and they're probably going to telemarket it unless, you know, there is something with this bill. But that is the concern that we would have, is that there is no pre-existing business relationship. It is a new business, and there's only two relationships established, and that is with PGE and PacifiCorp. So that's just an example of how we get why we get a little concerned about trying to put a blanket ban on telemarketing. And I'm sure the response could be, well, then a business doesn't have to sign up for the no-call list. And that's legitimate, but I'm not quite sure how you manage the side of getting enough information to have a competitive market be valuable in preventing the flow of information. So
Julie, help me understand this. If I understand correctly, this is a person, a business, that says, I don't want to receive these calls.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And what your argument is that notwithstanding that person's choice to not receive the calls, you believe it's appropriate to continue to call them or market to them?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you know, that's a tough question, because I think on the first example, on the if you establish a relationship like at the Chamber of Commerce or something, you might think putting your name down as a no-call will provide a service, but it also might prevent you from growing a business, your business, to do something new that you didn't know you could do before, finding a competitive energy supplier, for example.
Are there other ways to market?
There are. I would say they are not as efficient, Mr. Chair. The other concern that we would have in response to your question is, on one hand, legislatures across the nation have given us very strong mandates to provide competition in markets that were prior heavily regulated. And how are these markets that are supposed to become competitive not do that when they have no pre-existing business relation? And that is why I use that energy example. So those are our concerns.
Okay. Great. Question, Senator Ringo?
I would think it wouldn't be that hard to craft some language so that if there was any prior acquaintanceship, or for the Chamber of Commerce example, that you could create the exemption, because that's not a completely anonymous hit. It's not a complete cold call. It's a warm call.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator Ringo, I think that's what Senator Burdick is trying to do with that language, that it's the first initial language. Mm-hmm. The idea of a warm call is actually, when I was thinking how I would describe this to the committee, I was actually thinking of Corvallis, because I thought at least he would identify that. Mm-hmm. And although my husband does not have a business relationship with your extended family who runs the funeral home in Corvallis, we do have a very strong personal relationship with the family. Mm-hmm. But thank God we've never had to use the funeral home. So we have a warm relationship, but we do not have a business relationship.
Right. All right, Senator Burdick.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just on your point of, you know, giving people the opportunity to hear about marketing services, if you carried that the next step, some people use caller ID to not pick up unidentified calls. So, you know, why wouldn't you require people to pick up all their phone calls? I mean, if that was a priority and you were giving priority the person marketing the services, and say that it's in the public interest to have them be able to call anybody regardless of their preference, then why wouldn't you want to require that people pick up their phones?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator Burdick, the best way I can answer that question is probably by example, and I hope you'll let me do that. Caller ID, I believe, is primarily used in home. And there's a reason to, I think, the statutes and the debate on telemarketing at home during the dinner hours and your ability to sort of push those aside has been made. I don't know how much businesses use caller ID. I know if AOI refused to pick up any call that said, you know, caller unidentified, we might neglect picking up phone calls from our board members, potential members, people of concern, people with concerns about a position we have or not have. And so at a business that is, and associations are actually pretty competitive, we have to pick up the phone and we have to respond. So,
but Mr. Chair, if there were an easy way of eliminating only those calls you didn't want to get, then wouldn't that be good? And then you'd know when you picked up that phone that you really do want to hear from the person on the site.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I think you're making a point that is important, but again, I don't know who is to make that decision on behalf of a competitive organization like ours, what phone calls we should or should not get. And I go back to the example I gave before. If you're a business who has always purchased energy from one provider because that has been the law, and you have the opportunity to hear about a service that you did not know was moving into competition, then I think maybe you would want to hear about that, even though you think today I don't want to. In the future, you may. And especially as your company, if it's very dynamic, might change and need to learn about new services. Because we understand that, you know, 15 years ago, I didn't have a cell phone when I started working in this building. Services and options change, and they change quickly. And a lot of the way to find out about that is through telemarketing.
Mr. Chairman, my conscience is clear.
All right, then. Thank you. I think we're through the public testimony, unless there are other individuals who wish to testify who did not sign up. And I don't see anybody standing, jumping to their feet, saying, I must testify this. Bill, Senator Burdick, your pleasure is what?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 27.
You didn't do it. Work session. Senator Burdick moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 27. Discussion. Objections. There are no objections. It passes. Senator Burdick.
Chairman, I'm honored. I would move Senate Bill 27 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 27 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Are there any objections? The chair will dissent. Senator Burdick, you get to carry this fine puppy. I think we're done. Any other business before the committee? There is none. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.